Hold out your hat. And plunging his right hand into the barrel of gold, he drew out first one handful of discs and counted them into the hat. 1, 2, 10. Plunged again, counted out 7 more, said, "Wait a minute," to Anderson, and to his little dark shrewish assistant at the other 2 barrels, 17 and 4. Then to Anderson again, "That makes £17.17.4. And here is your witnessed paper, asking for £365 to be remitted to Mrs. Anderson. Are you content?" "Oh, deary me, yes," said Anderson, laughing. "Oh, yes, sir, quite content." "Then sign here," said the clerk. But seeing Anderson's uneasy look, he murmured, "Well, just make your mark in the bottom corner." And so it went, right through the list. There were a few men with no dependents of any kind, and they walked off with the entire 157th part of half the splendid prize. But most over 30 had yielded to the representations of their captain and divisional officers to send at least some money home, and all eagerly agreed with the clerk's reckoning. At one time, Stephen Maturin, the frigate's surgeon, had been calculating the degree of literacy aboard, but melancholy, no doubt helped by the increasing wind and the spindrift, had welled up, and he lost count among the names beginning with N. "How I do wish," he murmured to Jack in a moment's pause, "that William and his Ringers might have been here." "So do I, indeed. But, you know, as a privately owned tender to what is, in fact, a hydrographical vessel, I don't think they'd stand in line for more than 4. In any case, I couldn't refuse Lord Keith. He had no other suitable craft at hand. He asked it as a personal favour. And I owe him a great deal. I owe both of them a great deal." "Of course, of course. It was only that I should have liked some of the younger ones to accept a gold piece by way of memento," said Stephen. "How the waves increase, the darkness thickens." "They'll rejoin at Madeira," said Jack, "and then you can give them their gold pieces." They talked on quietly, until Jack realized that Willis and young husband had been dealt with, and that once Moses Zachary, one of the surprise's very old Sethian hands, had stopped chuckling over the coins that he obscurely insisted upon stuffing or trying to stuff into a variety of little inadequate triangular pockets, it would be time for him, as captain, to wind up proceedings. But the proceedings would not be wound up. In spite of the gathering darkness and the now quite vicious driving rain, some hand, probably Giles, captain of the foretop, called out, "It's all along of the unicorn's horn! It's all along of the glorious hand! Huzzay! 3 times huzzay for the doctor!" Lord, how they cheered their surgeon! It was he who had brought the narwhal's tusk aboard, and the severed hand, the hand of glory, was his property, both symbolized and practically guaranteed immense good fortune, virility, safety from poison or any disease you chose to name, and both had proved their worth. Jack Aubrey was a taut captain. He'd been brought up by commanders who looked upon exact discipline and exact gunfire as of equal importance in a man of war, but on this occasion he knew that he had nothing whatsoever to say, and speaking privately to his first lieutenant, he observed, "Mr. Harding, when things are a little calmer, let's weigh and proceed south-west by west with all the sail she can bear. If any king ship hails or signals, you will reply, 'Carrying dispatches,' and pursue your course, touching neither sheet nor brace." "South-west by west it is, sir, and carrying dispatches," said Harding. And Jack, steadying Stephen by the elbow, the frigate was pitching quite violently by now, guided him to the great cabin where they sat at their ease on the cushioned stern lockers that ran across the ship under the elegant, remarkably elegant sash lights that gave onto the sea. "I'm afraid it's going to turn out a truly dirty night," said Jack. He stood up and, in his sure-footed seaman's way, walked over to his barometer. Yes, he said. Dirtier than I'd thought. He came back and gazed out at the darkness, full of rain and flying water from the ship's bow wave, more and more as she increased her way. But, however, he went on, I'm most heartily glad to be at sea. At one time I thought it could never be done. Indeed, without Queenie and Lord Keith, it never would have been done. The stern lanterns were now lighting up the frigate's wake, exceptionally broad, white, and agitated for a ship with such fine lines. But in spite of the brilliance just aft, he could still clearly make out the distant red glow above Gibraltar, where they were still keeping it up in spite of the wind and the rain. For his own part, he'd had quite enough of the junketing, especially that part of it which consisted of patriotic songs, self-praise, and mocking the French, who had, after all, gone down fighting, outnumbered with the utmost gallantry. Jibes that very often came from those who had had nothing whatsoever to do with the war. Even Maturin, though he loathed the whole Napoleonic system, root and branch, couldn't bear the obscene, gloating caricatures of Bonaparte that were everywhere to be seen, a penny plain and up to as much as fourpence coloured. Do you remember Malta, when there was a payment of $6 a head for one share of men? Asked Jack. Now, of course you don't. You were at the hospital looking after poor Hopkins' leg. Well, I thought he'd an answer with a settled, steady crew of seamen, and they certainly expected it, the bag of silver having been hauled out of the tobacco's cabin and spilt on deck. But I was wrong. Once ashore, they kicked up Bob's a dying to a shocking extent, and then set about the soldiery. Indeed, I remember it. My colleagues and I had to treat many of them. Contusions, mostly, and some quite important fractures. So you did, said Jack, shaking his head. Then he stopped, listened intently, and ran on deck. Coming back, he wiped the foam and rain from his face with an habitual gesture, and said, fore topmast staysail carried away. A damned awkward veering wind and as black as the devil's arse. But young Wilcox was up there before I reached the forecastle, and they were tallying the new sheet aft as though it were broad daylight, and the sea as smooth as a pond. There you are, that's your seaman. He can put up with uncommon dirty weather, endure great hardship, and very short commons. A good, steady, courageous, uncomplaining creature under officers he can respect. He'll bear all that, and sometimes harsh punishment, shipwreck, and scurvy. What he cannot bear is sudden wealth. It goes straight to their heads, and if there's the least possibility, they get drunk and disorderly and desert in droves. In Malta, it wasn't so bad. With the help of the whores, their $6 were soon spent. And on an island, there was no chance of deserting. But now the case is altered, and each damn fool hand with 50 guineas in his pocket would have been blind drunk, poxed and stripped before Sunday, hadn't we got away? Besides, what is it, Killick? Which we shall have to ship washboard athwart the coach door. Green seas is coming aft as far as the capstan and getting worse every minute. I doubt we'll ever get your toasted cheese up dry without I bring up the spirit stove and do it here. Who has the deck at the moment? Why, the master, sir, in course. And he's just sent Mr. Daniel and a couple of strong hands aloft with a spare lantern, which the top light came adrift again. And, sir, addressing Stephen, your mate... beg his pardon, Dr. Jacob, as I ought to say, has had a nasty tumble. Blood all over the gunroom. Stephen tried to leap to his feet, but the roll of the ship pressed him back, and when he made a second attempt on the larboard heave, it flung him forward with shocking force. Both the captain and the captain's steward had the same notion of Stephen's seamanship, however. Between them, they held him steady, and Jack, grasping his windward elbow, guided him through the coach. The anteroom, as it were, to the great cabin, and so out onto the deck, where the blast, the utter darkness, thick with racing spindrift, rain, and even solid bodies of seawater, took his breath away, used though he was to the extremities of weather. "Mr. Woodbine," called Jack. "Sir," replied the master, just beside the wheel, where the faint glow of the binnacle could be made out by eyes growing accustomed to the darkness. "How's the top light coming along?"
I'm afraid we shall have to rouse out the armourer, sir. I doubt Mr. Daniel can fix the bracket without heavy tools.
Then, raising his voice, he called to the quartermaster, stationed to windward, watching the weather leeches.
Higgs, hail the top and ask if Mr. Daniel would like the armourer.
Higgs had an enormous voice and very keen ears. Through all the shrieking of the wind in the rigging and its roaring changes, he conveyed and received the message. By this time, Stephen could make out the small hand lantern high among the pattern of sails, all as close-hauled as ever they could be, with the frigate plunging westward through the tumultuous seas. He could also see the faint light reflected from the companion ladder, and towards this he crept, holding on to everything that offered, bowed against the wind and the blinding rain. But with each tentative step he took down, the frantic, uneven roll grew less, a question, as Jack had often told him, of the centre of gravity. Yet a most discreditable scene it was when he opened the larboard door of the bright-lit gunroom. Here were men, accustomed to bloodshed from their childhood, now running about like a parcel of hens, mopping Jacob's arm with their napkins, giving advice, proffering glasses of water, wine, brandy, loosening his neckcloth, undoing his breeches at the waist and the knee. The purser was literally wringing his hands.
"Pass the word for pulse keeping," cried Stephen, in a harsh, peremptory tone.
He thrust them aside, irrespective of rank, whipped out a lancet, always in a side pocket, slit Jacob's sleeve up to the shoulder, cut the shirt away, uncovered the spurting brachial artery, and two other ample sources of blood on the same limb. In turning a complete somersault over both his chair and a small stool with a glass in his hand, at the moment of a double rise on the part of the frigate followed by a sickening plunge, Jacob had contrived not only to stun himself but also to shatter the glass, whose broad, sharp-edged sides had severed the artery and many other smaller but still considerable vessels. Paul came at a run, carrying bandages, gut-threaded needles, pledgets and splints. Stephen, who had his thumb on the most important pressure point, desired the members of the gunroom to stand back, right back, and Paul instantly set about swabbing, dressing, and even tidying the patient before he was carried off to a sick Perth cot. All this had called for a good deal of explanation and comment, and when Jack came below telling Mr. Harding that they were making truly remarkable way, barely 6 points off the wind, whole tedious thing seemed to be happening again, with people showing just what had happened and how it had happened, when a truly enormous, an utterly shocking crash checked the frigate's way entirely, thrusting her off her course and swinging the lantern so violently against the deck overhead that two went out, a crash that drove all discussion of Jacob's injuries far, far from the collective mind. Jack shot up on deck, followed by the whole gunroom. He could at first see nothing in the roaring darkness, but Hewell, the officer of the watch, told him that the forward starboard lookout had hailed light on the starboard bow seconds before the enormous impact, that he himself had seen a huge, dark and otherwise lifeless craft coming right before the wind at 10 knots or more, strike the frigate's bows, cross her shattered stern, and run down her larboard side, her yards sweeping surprises shrouds, but always breaking free. A very heavy Scandinavian timber carrier, he thought. Ship-rigged. Could see no name, no port, no flag. No hail came across. He roused out the boatswain and the carpenter. They would report in a moment. The ship was steering still, though she sagged to leeward. Jack ran forward to meet them. "Bust written most of the head carried away, sir," said the carpenter. "Nor I shouldn't answer for the foremast," said the boatswain. A carpenter's mate addressed his chief. "We might be in water. 5 ton a minute," in a tone of penetrating anxiety that affected all who heard him. Harding had already called all hands, and as they came tumbling up, Jack put the ship before the wind, furling everything but the main and forecourses and manning the pumps. She answered her helm slowly, and she sailed slowly. But once Jack had her, with the very strong wind and the short pounding sea on her uninjured larboard quarter, she no longer gave him that desperate sense of being about to founder any minute, and he and the carpenter and Harding, each with a lantern, made their tour of inspection. What they found was very, very bad. Bowsprit, head and all the gear swept clean away, headsails gone, of course, and there were certainly some sprung butts lower down. But by the end of the middle watch, with the carpenter...